Thank you, Judge Roy. May it please the court. Tom Carberry appearing for Mr. Gonzalez. This case presents very bad facts, both factually and legally. Obviously, with this defendant, Mr. Gonzalez was convicted of a very serious stranger rape. And from what we know, he's got at least three prior convictions under what may or may not be his real name. The real issue here is, do the rules of attorney-client privilege and duty of loyalty apply to this man? And I think it's pretty clear that the lawyers here, although they acted in good faith, it seems like they talked to their superiors, their public defender superiors, and got advice on what to do. They made a big mistake because Schulteis issued in 1981, and this happened in 1999 or 2000. And their duty was to say nothing, to not disclose. They couldn't go to trial knowing that their client was under a false name. That I have to agree with the Attorney General. That would be obstruction of justice. I think you can't fraudulently go to court knowing your client is under a fraudulent name. I don't have any case law to say that, but I think it's pretty apparent to all of us that that's true.
I think there are ethical rules.
Ethical rules, exactly. But then there's also the duty of loyalty to the client, and Schulteis makes clear that when you know your client is going to do something wrong and you cannot dissuade your client, because the first step is to dissuade the client, to try to convince the client, come forward and tell the truth. But of course, you have to tell the client under that circumstances that if you do tell the truth, the DA is going to find your priors, you're going to get convicted, they might use it as 404B evidence, and you're going to probably spend the rest of your life in prison. So the next question is, what do they do? And under Schulteis, the issue is you have to withdraw. You have to tell the court, I have an irreconcilable conflict of interest. That's the language. And in Schulteis, they made that generic language that would cover all these different circumstances so it would not prejudice the trial judge. We have a phrase that we can use in Colorado when you have this sort of situation. And that's the real issue and the hard issue in this case. Because it is,
Mr. Carberry, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just noticed the clock doesn't appear to be running.
Oh.
I know you're like a lot of time.
I don't think I really need that amount of time.
Now, while I interrupted you, if I can ask you a question, I am aware of Schulteis and looked at it, and those facts are a little bit different, of course, because we have a client who wants to put on perjured testimony. In this case, I think one thing that kind of glossed over, you make a very compelling argument here. You don't really address in your brief, and I'm curious if you'd address it now, the question of, was this confidential information? I mean, it strikes me you have to have this piece first. I mean, I can't remember if I read it in the Attorney General's brief or saw somewhere the argument that this is all public record, what his name is. So what in the record tells us that this was confidential information in the front end? Because if it wasn't, I don't think we have a Schulteis problem at all.
Yeah, I think that's a very important issue. And that was actually addressed in the unpublished opinion in the direct appeal. But in a flip side of the argument, in that argument, in that appeal, the defendant argued that the judge, once he learned that, should not have turned that over to the prosecution. I can't agree with that, and the court didn't agree with that, because the judge is in a different position than the defense attorney. The judge's duty is to, you know, the judge has many duties, but to the judicial system, to both parties, but not, he doesn't have a duty of confidentiality to the defendant in this case. He has a duty to make the truth known. So I don't think that was the legal issue. The real legal issue is, and as you expressed it, is this confidential information? And in that Court of Appeals opinion, they said that it was that the man's name was public knowledge. But let's look at this factually and truthfully, because this was only a few days before trial. They had this defendant's fingerprints, the police did. They'd run it. They'd provided all their background checks. And just as they're required by Rule 16, they're required to give the defense NCIC reports and the CCIC reports. And they'd done that, and they had not discovered this information. And the only way they discovered it was when the defense told the prosecution, this is his real name, this is his real date of birth, and he's got a potential sexual assault felony out of Illinois. I think it's, you know, I don't want to use this in a pejorative term, because, you know, philosophically, you know, we use the term sophists. I don't think sophistry is the, you know, because sophistry is actually, I think, a good way to approach things. But I don't think factually it was anything but privileged information, because even if the prosecution could have learned it, what the defense had was information they learned only from their client. Only from their client. And that was what they could not turn over. It may have been in the sense, in the broader sense, that it was public information in the, you know, the world of reality, but it wasn't from the defense counsel point of view. From the defense counsel point of view, they only learned it from the defendant. The prosecution had never turned that over to them. And it's a terrible dilemma, because here we are 10 years later. And, you know, do we have witnesses still available? This is a very difficult case. I don't know what this court intends to do, but I think that's where we are. I think, Judge Gabriel, you pointed to one area of the case that I obviously did not address that, but I think it's a question of what is public knowledge. If I could, I'd like to just very briefly address the second issue, because
before you get off that, the first issue, let me ask you this question. Isn't the issue here whether or not that disclosure made by counsel represents an actual conflict of interest?
Well, I think it does, because, Judge Hoffman, once they made that disclosure, that's obviously a violation of the ethical rules of Rule 1.6, and that was in effect in 1999. And I think the case law is pretty clear. Once you, a lawyer is accused of an ethical violation or a criminal violation, because a lot of the cases deal with, which are both, you're like suggesting that your client flee to Israel. I mean, that's both an ethical violation and a criminal violation. And in here, once they made this ethical violation, they had a conflict. I don't think they could have proceeded. I think they didn't believe they had a conflict, because I think they went to their bosses and found out about this, which was strange, because we have I didn't cite this in the briefs, and it's an unpublished opinion, but almost at the same time, there was a remarkably similar disclosure by the same public defender's office in Colorado Springs in a murder case, where the lawyer got the client to write an apology letter to the family. And the client was only 15, and that was, almost at the same time. And it's not, they had an internal problem with ethics in this office. And I can't blame these two lawyers themselves, because they obviously went and checked it out. But they did make an ethical violation. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The other issues, I don't know.
Was there any evidence in this 35C proceeding that counsel's representation of defendant was materially limited by allegiance to his own interests or allegiance to another client or to another person?
Well, Judge Hawthorne, I think there are two answers to that. The first is that when there's a conflict of interest, you don't have to prove that under Castro. But the second answer is yes, I think there was. They did a very poor job with the rape shield statute. They didn't really seem to understand it. They filed a generic motion on it. That was another issue on the 35C. But the real prejudice to the defendant afterwards is, he got convicted. Let's say that he would have got convicted no matter what. But his punishment was, in a case like this, he's going to get a severe punishment no matter what. But as I discussed in the brief, his punishment was, one indeterminate life sentence followed by a 48-year determinate life sentence followed by another indeterminate life sentence. So, he's never going to get out. So his punishment was aggravated by the disclosure by the defense, because the judge did aggravate based on those priors. That's clear from the record.
In response to Judge Hawthorne's question, the conflict here, it seems to me, if I'm understanding your argument, there's a conflict between the defense lawyer's ethical duty as the defense lawyer understood it and the client's right to not have that information disclosed. Is that fair?
That's correct.
One last question at this point. I know you want to move on to the other issues, and I'd like to hear them. Is there a law of the case problem given the prior Court of Appeals ruling on this confidentiality issue?
Well, law of case is a complex issue, and there's no doubt that the previous panel said that this was public information. So, but I think that there's also, you have to look at the reality of the situation. Is it public or not? And I'm asking this panel to say that no, it wasn't. That's all I can say on that.
Thank you.
And as to the, I do a lot of this post-conviction work, and on the 35C council, and this lawyer who was appointed was unfortunately, like many lawyers who do 35C work, didn't actually know what he was doing. Who knows what he did, but a couple of years after he was on this, he files a motion to withdraw, at the same time files a motion saying, well, I'm moving to Florida, here's my new address. And, you know, it's obvious from my briefs that there were legal issues in this. And that's something that, if, you know, I don't know if you can do this in an opinion, but this is something the courts have to look at, that there's a giant problem going on with 35C law, not in the law itself, but in the way that it's handled in the district courts. There are too many lawyers that don't know what they're doing. There are too many, you know, the judges are obviously overworked. They want to shove it aside. And so there's no real supervision of what's going on. And in here, in this case, once the judge made a finding that he deserved to have a lawyer, and then the lawyer just sort of bails on it at the end, we need to have something where the lawyer, if you're going to leave, you don't just say, I didn't find anything, but say, you know, I read this transcript, I read this, I did this, and put the lawyer on the record. So later, if it becomes apparent that it's not true, that lawyer at least has got some, you know, some type of follow-up from the courts.
Is there any discussion, Mr. Carberry, and the procedure is odd, and I recall vividly, as you said, the lawyer said, withdraw, I don't see any issues, and here's my change of address. But then the court had a hearing. Was there, I mean, that strikes me as very odd, that the court seemed to think that there were real issues here. You raised some, that Henderson issue is very difficult, and struck me. Was there any discussion when the lawyer withdrew about denying the motion to withdraw, or any discussion at this point about there are still legal issues when the court said we're going to have a hearing anyway? How do we get from the defense lawyer says there are no, I don't see any meritorious issues, to the court saying we're going to have a hearing anyway?
And I agree with that, Judge Gabriel, and that's, I actually put it that in at least in one paragraph in my brief, that I think the judge abused discretion just by not following the procedural rules of 35C as they go. And we don't have any evidence that he submitted the brief to the public defenders at any point? Did it go right to alternate defense counsel? Then, and then, you know, when he dismisses the attorney, then all of a sudden we have a hearing. I agree that it's, who knows what that means.
Yeah, and I probably didn't ask my question well, and I apologize. I was just curious if there's any factually and anything specifically in the record on this point. Because I'll say with you, and your friend across the room there is going to hear this from me as well, I would agree in the abstract that once the lawyer gets appointed, the court, you know, goes through all the hoops it's supposed to, we've got a lawyer representing the person. The statutes do say the public defender and ADC do not have to proceed if there's, they don't think there's meritorious claim, they can get out. I'm not sure, and we have case law from this court that says you get a substitute lawyer at that point. However, this case strikes me as at least possibly different because there seem to be meritorious issues, and it just strikes me as odd the court didn't deny the motion to withdraw. I'm just, I guess, expressing my concerns, but I'm just curious if there's anything in the record about this.
Only the letter from the court to the defendant saying, well, we got rid of your lawyer, but we're going to have a hearing and you got to do it by yourself. That's the only thing I can remember.
Sorry to go on so long to get my question out.
This is the longest oral argument I've had in my whole career. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. I'd like to start with your questions, Judge Gabriel. The same thing happened in Starkweather. The defendant was appointed counsel. Counsel, the PD, determined that the claims had no arguable merit, and it went to hearing, and the defendant represented himself. And I think here the judge...
Excuse me, Ms. Van Horn. In that case, did the district court determine that there was arguable merit to the defendant's motion prior to that?
I think in that case the court just sent it over to the public defender. In this case, the court said it couldn't really determine whether there was arguable merit. There could be arguable merit. And if you look at the court's order denying the 35C motion, the court said it was difficult to discern what the defendant's claims were because he had attached pleadings that were obviously filed by a different defendant, ineffective assistance of counsel claims. So I think in this case what the court was saying is difficult for me to tell whether there's arguable merit, so I'm going to appoint counsel. And contrary to what the defendant says, there is information in this record that shows that a copy of this motion was served on the public defender. So I just...
Is there arguable merit? Is there arguable merit?
To the ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Yes.
No, there was not.
Matter of law?
I think if, once you get through these, it was very, very difficult to discern what the defendant was arguing in his pro se 35C motion. But once you narrow down the defendant's claims, I mean, I read a lot of pro se claims. There was not arguable merit to any of these claims. He was saying his attorneys failed to investigate. He was saying his attorneys failed to call alibi witnesses. He was saying that his attorneys, and then at the hearing, he was saying that his attorneys didn't speak Spanish and were unable to communicate with him, and that sort of
thing. These are the things he said pro se. Let me take two issues, and I'd be interested in you addressing them. Let's say he had an actual lawyer helping him. If I remember this right, this defendant got convicted of attempted sexual assault and sexual assault. Mr. Carberry argues they should merge. You say it wasn't raised. And so, and my point is not to criticize anybody here, of course, but it seems to me a lawyer may have picked that up and said, there's a double jeopardy issue. The Henderson issue, again, you concede that a kind of defendant pro se sort of got around the edges of this issue, and then you say he didn't pursue it at the hearing. Again, I have, frankly, have some issues with that, the pro se lawyer, the defendant thinking he should raise every issue. But we have the U.S. Supreme Court can't come to a decision on whether that issue, you know, where that issue is after Apprendi. It seems that, how is that not arguable merit to that point when the U.S. Supreme Court is debating it?
Part of the problem I have with this case is, in the opening brief, he really didn't specify what was wrong and why. There were a lot of assertions.
Say opening brief, you're talking about the defendant's pro se brief?
Opening brief here.
Okay.
In the Court of Appeals. He didn't put in facts. He didn't even, for example, bring up the fact that there were two separate sexual assaults. He tried to force the victim to perform oral sex, and then he raped her. He tore off her pants and raped her. So there was one, the attempt, and there was a sexual assault, and then there was the kidnapping. Well, he didn't explain how any of these facts related to any of the law he cited. He cited the Wolhoff, which really doesn't apply here in part. Some of it he was saying he recognized that this court would be bound by our Supreme Court's decisions in these cases, but he was preserving it for habeas review. So there was not, it wasn't even so much that he didn't raise these issues at the post-conviction hearing or in his post-conviction motion. He sort of made an Apprendi reference. He didn't explain here why this was wrong, why this was in violation of Apprendi, what the facts were here, and how the law in Colorado applies to the facts in this case, when he was represented by counsel. And I can make assumptions. I could assume, oh, is he saying this or is he saying that? But that puts me in a bad position to try to guess what the defendant's arguing. And that's what happened with some of these claims, and the same thing with the first claim, this conflict claim. In the opening brief, put in some case law, put in some assertions, but never truly explained how the facts and the law applied here.
If I may follow up, Ms. Van Horn, I promise I won't monopolize all your time. So picking up on the Starkweather issue, if you have a situation, let's take the hypothetical, where you've got defense counsel, ADC, moving to withdraw, and then the court thinks there's merit to the issue. Yeah, but the court's saying, I'm not going to keep this guy in town. He's moving to Florida. He's already got his plane ticket. Do you think in that situation the court has a duty to appoint substitute counsel? So in other words, the court thinks there's arguable merit here, even though the defense lawyer doesn't. Is not the defendant entitled to counsel at that point?
Well, the court's, of course, looking at the claims that the defendant has presented and wants to present in his post-conviction motion. The court is not going to go through the whole record of the case and see if there were other claims that the defendant could have presented in a post-conviction motion. So the court's dealing with what it's given as far as what the defendant's claims are. So at that point, that is what the court is looking at, the defendant's own pro se motion, what the defendant wanted to present, and then looking at the attorney's decision whether this has arguable merit or not. Now, if the court independently looked at the defendant's pro se motion and thought, as it is required to do, and thought this attorney is wrong, there might be some arguable merit here, I think the court then has discretion to appoint counsel. The court in this case said it didn't think it could get another attorney from ADC, but
Then the court said it was barred. I thought the court said, please correct me, I thought the court said it was barred, or I thought it was no possibility of appointing new counsel. Or it was stronger language.
I'm just talking in general. In this specific case, I think if we look at these claims the defendant raised in his post-conviction motion and looked at them very closely, they don't have arguable merit. It's just that brief on its face. I just think the court did this because it was rather confusing what the defendant was presenting in his motion and his allegations and what he was trying to present, because it was clear he was had used some other person's pleadings.
What I got from this and reading what the district court did was say, look, the defendant used someone else's form. And if defendant's counsel, this defendant's counsel, did what Mr. Davis's counsel did, then there might be some arguable merit. So I'm going to appoint counsel for defendant so we can proceed. It appeared to me that the trial court or the district court was saying, I can't really tell, but I'm going to give the defendant the benefit of the doubt.
That's the way I read it.
And then when defendant's post-conviction counsel comes back and says, I don't find any arguable merit, then the trial court says, well, I'm not going to appoint another attorney for you after one has already said that there's no arguable merit to your claims.
And that's the way I took it, that the court was looking at it. The court didn't really determine there was arguable merit. It determined there could be, and to be on the safe side, I'm going to appoint counsel.
And I have another question for you before I forget it. You had indicated a little bit earlier that there is evidence in the record that the trial court or the district court did contact the public defender's office and sent the motion over to the public defender's office. Can you tell me where that is?
I have the record site in my brief.
It is in your brief?
Yes.
Okay. I'll look it up again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Edwin, I was going to just follow up on Judge Hawthorne's question. So when we got to the point when the lawyer now says, I don't see any arguable merit, is there anything in the record as to whether the judge did anything more? In other words, did the judge just take counsel's word for it at that point, or is there something in the record to say, you know, I don't remember what the letter said. I remember the court sent a letter to the defendant. Does the court say, and I have independently looked at this, and I don't see anything either, so I'm not going to appoint you another lawyer, or what?
No, what I gathered from the record is that the trial court then said, but I'll still let you have the evidentiary hearing, and if you want to go ahead and present your claims at the evidentiary hearing, I'll let you do that.
And
the court really wasn't making a merits determination at that point. It was holding off to give the defendant the opportunity to have the evidentiary hearing and present his arguments and his attorney and that kind of thing as evidence.
Is the court, and last thing on this, and I'll leave you alone, does the court have any duty at that point to investigate? So here's the defense lawyer says, I don't see any arguable merit. Does the court have some duty to do something? Or can the court just take defense lawyer's word and say motion to withdraw is granted?
I think the court did what it needed to do in this case. I think the court looked at the motion itself, and that's all it needed to do. I don't think the court can do anything more at that point, because then it's actually making its merits determination, its potential merits determination, which it's going to have to do anyway. And this defendant's suggestion that somehow we should require the attorney to come in and explain why he or she didn't think the case has merit, I think, is problematic for the reasons I gave in my answer brief. It puts that attorney in a very bad position against the defendant, and I think then you would have to appoint the defendant a new attorney to question that attorney, or I don't even know how that would work. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that the trial court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
I don't know how much time you have, Mr. Carberry, but
I just have three brief points, if I may.
First, as to the Wohlhoff double jeopardy issue, I know Ms. Van Horn characterizes as, you know, the attempt to the oral sexual assault and then the vaginal sexual assault, but I think under Wohlhoff, that's pretty clear that that's one sexual assault. You know, you don't parse that down. The second issue is, Judge Hawthorne, on to the question about what with the with this generic 35C, pro se 35C, you have to also remember that by the time the 35C came out, the direct appeal opinion had come out, and the first issue in that appeal was whether the judge was biased by getting this information over to the defense counsel. By then, Judge Schwartz must have been thinking about this and realized that there was something wrong with this hearing that he had with the public defenders, this ex parte hearing. And, you know, I cited in my brief that the judge is presumed to know the law, and the law of Schultes has been around for a long time. So I think that that was a problem, that with the 35C, the court knew that there was a legal issue with the defense counsel's conflict of interest. And then finally, Judge Gabriel asked your question about the court's duty to investigate once the attorney said that he found no arguable merit. I'd like to say that the answer to that is yes, but I think practically speaking, I don't think you can put that burden on the district court judges. I mean, you have to put the burden on the lawyers. I mean, it's got to be the lawyer's burden at that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for their arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.